Hi, this is The Takeaway for Tuesday, September 12th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're glad you're with us here today. And we begin this hour in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma, in the place that was most devastated by its rage. Irma was a Category 5 hurricane when it slammed into the island of Barbuda. It's the smaller part of the island nation of Antigua and Barbuda. It was the storm's first landfall before grinding its way through the rest of the Caribbean and then up to Florida. Irma flattened Barbuda, damaging an estimated 95% of the island's structures. The entire island of about 1,800 people was evacuated. I spoke with Ambassador Ronald Sanders. He's been Antigua and Barbuda's ambassador to the United States since 2015.
The damage is complete. For the first time in 300 years, there's not a single living person on the island of Barbuda. A civilization that has existed in that island for close to over 300 years has now been extinguished. We had to evacuate everybody from Barbuda. Hurricane Irma was a monster. It was 378 miles wide when it hit Barbuda, which is only 62 square miles. So that you can imagine, this was a huge monster and very powerful, gusting at winds of 220 miles an hour, hanging over Barbuda for several hours. The island and the people on the island had absolutely no chance. And this was a Category 5 plus hurricane. What hit Florida was a Category 4, and it, of course, weakened after that. But Barbuda had the full brunt of what has been the most ferocious, the most cruel, and the most merciless storm that we have seen in history.
Has Antigua been able to absorb the population of Barbuda and take everybody in and make sure they have a place to live and go to school?
Fortunately for Antigua did not suffer damage from Irma, so it remained open for business and still is. And we've evacuated all of the people to Antigua. We've got 500 kids. We've got to find school places for almost immediately because, of course, the school term has started. But we've had most of the people that we have brought over to Antigua in shelters. We've tried to make living accommodation as good as humanly possible in these circumstances. Fortunately, we had planned ahead for this hurricane and we had ordered supplies in from Miami in the United States before the hurricane hit, so that we were able to deploy these resources to aid the people of Barbuda that we brought over to Antigua. But the living conditions are not great. It can't be. People have been forced into cramped living. You know, they're sharing toilets. It's government facilities in which they are being located. We've opened some others. We've taken a nursing home, for instance, and converted that into accommodation. And Antiguans have been very generous in opening their homes to some of the Barbudans, particularly those with young children. But the situation is unacceptable and it is costly. We are going to have to keep this going for some time because Barbuda is not going to be rebuilt in a hurry. And when we do rebuild it, we're going to have to rebuild it to massive hurricane standards. So this is going to take a while. There is no electricity there. There is no potable water anymore. There is no structure in which people can survive. So we have a mammoth task on our hands. It is a task, incidentally, to which my government will give its very best, but we are a small island community. The gross domestic product of Antigua is $1 billion a year. So we cannot afford to take on this responsibility by ourselves. Barbuda is not just a disaster, it's a humanitarian crisis. And we are hopeful that the international community will come to our aid, not because we are begging for something we want, but because we are begging for something that is needed.
I want to ask you a little more about what it means to rebuild Barbuda, Ambassador. Basically, human civilization on that island was erased. You mentioned the need to rebuild not just in the way things were, but to rebuild to hurricane standards. Do you have a sense that everybody who came from Barbuda is going to want to go back? Is that island going to return to its pre-Irma state? Or might some people just decide to stay on Antigua or do something else?
I'm sure there will be some who have decided to stay on Antigua, but the Barbudan community has been there on that island for generations, over 300 years, as I explained to you earlier. So there is a very strong feeling that Barbuda is their homeland. And yes, they will want to go back to Barbuda. Plus, that is where all of their possessions are. That's where their ancestors are buried. That's where they were born. The sense of identification with Barbuda is very powerful. And they will want to go back. Barbuda has some of the most beautiful beaches in the world, incidentally. And it's crystal clear water with pink sand beaches. You stand in that water and up to your neck, and you can look down and see your toes. So it's a beautiful place for tourism. What we have to ensure now is that when we rebuild it, all of the buildings on the island can withstand hurricane forces of the kind and magnitude that we've seen, because we believe climate change is here to stay. It's a reality, despite all of the naysayers. We have now to build to cope with it, to have the resilience to deal with it, and to make sure that a crisis of this kind doesn't happen again.
Well, Ambassador, you're speaking to me from Washington, D.C. right now, a place where there's a debate about climate change, whether humans are involved. We're all familiar with that debate. We're going to be talking about it later in the show as well. Is there a debate in Antigua and Barbuda? Do people there have any doubt that climate change is affecting their lives and will in the future?
None at all. We absolutely believe that there's climate change. And we know that these things have occurred as a result of the profligacy of countries that are rich and have abused the system. And we, unfortunately, who contribute less than 0.0% of the pollution of the world's atmosphere, are the world's greatest victims.
Do you have any sense of the price tag for rebuilding now in your country?
It's a rough estimate, because we have not really been able to go in yet to do the kind of assessment that is needed. The Canadians, who sent in a team yesterday, I think will help us to make that assessment. But the rough estimate is that it's to the tune of $200 million.
And you would like that recovery aid to come from where? A combination of countries, from the United Nations? Do you have an idea there?
Well, we've declared a state of emergency in Barbuda, because it is a complete disaster and uninhabitable. But Barbuda is not just a disaster, it's a humanitarian crisis. And we believe that the international community should respond to a humanitarian crisis in a humanitarian way. And we would hope that the major countries of the world would want to sit with us to look at the sustainable development plan that we will produce and to help us to fund it. We cannot cope with it from our own resources alone. No country with a sudden influx of 3% of its population could possibly deal with that rapidly. It doesn't matter which country it is. It's worse for countries that are as small as mine, whose resources are extremely limited. And I have to say that if Antigua had been affected, we would have been in great trouble. Fortunately, Antigua remains open for business, so tourism and so on is still continuing. But had we not had that, and had we not had that income, I have no idea how we would have survived.
No country in the Caribbean hit harder than Antigua and Barbuda. Barbuda essentially wiped out by Hurricane Irma. Ambassador Ronald Sanders is the ambassador to the United States from Antigua and Barbuda. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for joining us, and we wish you the best in helping your country rebuild.
Well, sir, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Let's go northwest in the Caribbean now to the U.S. Virgin Islands. Those include main islands like St. Croix, St. John, and St. Thomas. There are some surrounding minor islands as well. But at least four people were killed when Hurricane Irma hit those islands. Dr. Eugene Doc Peterson is a native of St. Croix and a retired veterinarian who's now a singer and a musician, and he's a part-time radio host. Now, Doc has been using the airwaves to help people in the neighboring islands that have been more severely affected by Irma. Doc Peterson, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
Doc, how you doing there on St. Croix?
St. Croix is doing very well. It's the other island, the other neighboring islands, especially to the north of us, that got hit pretty hard.
And so what have you all been doing there in St. Croix to help out?
Actually, it turned out well, because St. Croix is being used as a staging area to supply, bring in supplies to service those areas that were hit very hard. We have an excellent airport here in St. Croix, so the big military jets could come in and land, and FEMA could get their supply into St. Croix, and then either by boat or by small airplane and helicopters, take the supplies over to St. Thomas.
Now, Doc, you're on the air there in St. Croix, and probably your signal goes to some of the surrounding islands, too. People listen to your show, and I know they're calling in. Tell me how you're using your show.
Unfortunately, for the first 4 or 5 days after the hurricane, after Irma passed through, many of the radio stations on those islands were down for various reasons. The antennas got knocked over, or there were no electricity, of course, and so they were off air. Now they're coming up one by one. But here in St. Croix, our station, WSTX, which is an AM station, was able to reach out and disseminate information. And we get the information from the regular weather channel, NOAA. So after the hurricane hit, we're able to give pertinent information as to where, you know, searching for individuals that were lost, or if we have people that are looking for individuals, we could have their names registered here. And then if the person call in, say, I'm okay, then we could contact that person or have them listen to the station and know that their friends and family are safe and sound. The Red Cross, the electric company, the medical hospital, everyone uses not only this station, but other stations on the island to disseminate that pertinent information.
Doc, I want to make sure that I ask you about the federal response. You mentioned FEMA planes landing in St. Croix and staging there. Have people been satisfied with the response from Washington and the federal emergency aid response so far?
Yes, you know, in the past, some of the response had been very slow, and so there were some complaints with some of the other hurricanes. This particular one, it seems to be playing out fairly well. But like everything else, people are hurt, they're confused, they're wondering about their future, they're wondering about their jobs. If you ever had the opportunity, which I hope you have not, to go to bed one night or go to bed in the evening and wake up the next morning with everything that you own been destroyed and in disarray. The banks are closed. The hospital is damaged. You have people that need medical attention, such as dialysis patients and things like that, that needs to be taken care of immediately. And, you know, you could tell, you could see what kind of stressful situation that is, and people would be frustrated and feel out of whack. But I think that this particular time that things are flowing, FEMA was here, we saw some of their activities, some of my friends who live near the airport, their big complaint now is that these big jets are flying in and out constantly, and of course, you know, they make a lot of noise. So, but there are a lot of activities, helicopters going back and forth. And a lot of that, even just the buzz that goes on, gives the people that are in distress some confidence that something is happening.
That's Eugene Doc Peterson, a native of St. Croix, retired veterinarian, singer, musician, and part-time radio host there in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Doc, thanks again.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Zwillick. Americans have been focused on giant storms in the southern U.S., but out west, it's wildfire season, and this one in some places is the worst on record. Multiple wildfires have been burning from Montana to Washington State and down through California. More than 1 million acres of forest have burned so far this year. Wildfires this time of year are common in the West, but as we've talked about on this show all summer long, the intensity and duration of fires is something new, and that means the pollution they leave behind is also worse. The fires fill the air with smoke and coat wide areas with ash, making for unhealthy air conditions, but intense fires also threaten watersheds in the forests and ultimately drinking water for millions of people in the West. Tom Martin is president and CEO of the American Forest Foundation, and he joins me now. Tom Martin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
I mentioned that this fire season out west is worse than usual. Can you just remind us why?
Yeah, there are a couple of things going on here. First, wildfire in recent years is not only happening in a more intense way than it has in the past, the season for it is getting longer and longer. That means more forest acres are consumed. At the moment, it's 12,500 square miles. We got 75 big fires still going on, and it's really straining the ability of the 26,000 firefighters out there to really do anything about it.
We should mention Montana, where they're setting records for the hottest and driest summer and a fire season that started a month earlier than usual.
Yeah, it's really amazing. We had this great winter, a lot of snowpack, a lot of precipitation, and then it got dry and hot and drier and hotter and drier and hotter. And now the West is covered in smoke. I was just out there with my son. We drove 8 hours along the West Coast from Northern California to Portland. And I got to tell you, there was smoke everywhere. And this was just 10 days ago.
So you mentioned the snowpack that collects in the winter and then melts. And I want to talk about the relationship between these fires and water. That water filters down out of the mountains in a lot of places through the forests. When these fires burn and they burn hotter and longer than usual, how does that affect the water that flows near them?
So fire's natural in a forested landscape. What's unnatural is this more intense fire, the longer season, and the amount of wood that is out there. It's created much more fodder for the fire to burn, much more kindling, and it allows the fire to not just burn at a low level along the forest floor, but begin to burn very hot through the crowns of even the big trees. When it burns that hot, it literally can bake the soil. Why does that matter? Well, we get our drinking water. About half of Americans in the West, it's even more, get their drinking water off these forested landscapes. And the forests provide two things for us. One, a filter to give us cleaner water. And secondly, they hold the water over time and release it more slowly so that you don't get one big shot of water coming off in the winter. You get a longer, slower release, so we've got water deeper into the season. That's a good thing. When the fire actually bakes the soil, you can lose that ability.
Do you also get more sediment in the water if the forests help clean that water? What happens when there's more ash, more soot, and more fire?
Ty, that's a great point. So, for instance, we're doing work now with Denver Water. We work with private landowners, having them take voluntary actions to make their land more resistant to catastrophic wildfire. And so Denver had half of this one watershed that's a key part of their water supply burn up a few years ago. They've had to spend tens of millions of dollars to dig out the soot, the ash, the kinds of things that would really play havoc with their water filtration system. They want to prevent it in the future, so they want to begin to see the rest of the landscape become more fire resilient. So we're working with them to do that. But unfortunately, there's too many places where we've not yet taken on the issue of how do we get ahead of these catastrophic wildfires and do it in a way that preserves the ecosystem that we all care about.
Are the engineers and the hydrologists who work at reservoirs and filtration plants and in utilities across the West starting to wonder about the effect of these fires on water quality? What are they doing?
So the more forward-looking ones are saying, okay, what can we do upstream to lessen the likelihood of catastrophic wildfire? How can we think beyond the concrete that we poured up to that natural ecosystem, and how can we keep that ecosystem more fire resilient? Generally, that means removing some of the tinder that's out there, taking out some of the brush, the small trees, in some cases, exotic species that have moved in, and restoring the landscape to what it was before we started suppressing wildfire in this country.
Tom Martin, there's another issue that so many experts like you who've come on the show have talked about, and that's how much more closely people are living to fire zones. Maybe the fire zones are bigger, but people want to live near the forest. They want to live near those big lands, and that's an interface, the human-fire interface, that puts a lot of people at risk.
It absolutely puts a lot of people at risk. As you know, Rolling Stone did a story a couple of years ago about the coming conflagration in New Jersey. You don't think of New Jersey and wildfire together. But as you think about the Pine Barrens and the fact that it has gotten thicker and thicker and thicker and fire's been suppressed, you look and you see the same kind of conditions coming down the road in a place like New Jersey that we associate with rural America in the West. People do live close to places because of their beauty, because of the wonderful environmental services, these beautiful things that come from forests, but they're also sometimes putting themselves in harm's way.
Well, Tom, you mentioned that so much of Westerners' water supply comes from these forested watersheds. Are there any places where actual water quality has started to decline? Have you noticed any water systems that are having pollution problems right now because of fire?
Denver's, again, a very good example of one that's had to go in, intervene upstream to be able to protect its water quality. And it's not easy because most of our forests are not publicly owned. Most of our forests are privately owned, most of them by families and individuals. The families and individuals want to do the right thing. Overwhelmingly, they want to reduce fire risk on their land, but it's really bloody expensive. And so their ability to be able to reduce the fire risk for all of us is dependent upon them finding some resources or some markets so that when they lower the fire risk on their land and incur those expenses, there's something there to help them with it.
Tom Martin, President and CEO of the American Forest Foundation. Thanks for being with us, Tom.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Todd.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And let's go to Houston now, where much of the area still remains waist deep underwater. Houston is home to a large oil refining industry, and there are dozens of petrochemical plants there. There are also more than two dozen federally designated toxic waste sites. When Harvey made landfall on the 25th, afterward, environmental groups looked at available data for that week, and they found that over 40 facilities in the Houston area released a combined 4.6 million pounds of airborne emissions. That number exceeds environmental limits. Still, state regulators and plant officials told the public that residents shouldn't be concerned about those recent emissions. The environmental groups in the area are not convinced, however. Luke Metzger is director of the advocacy group Environment Texas, and he joins me now. Luke, welcome.
Thanks, Todd.
I just mentioned those reports that many of the plants emitted a lot of extra emissions and chemicals into the air by shutting down before the storm, by restarting after the storm. What do we know?
Yeah, the tally has grown since that estimate. We now count something like 7.9 million pounds of unauthorized pollution in the flooded areas, and that comes from shutting down in many cases too quickly, waiting to the last minute to shut down and then having excess emissions, as well as failure to modernize these plants and invest in pollution controls that could have minimized these emissions. And so we're talking about very harmful pollutants, including benzene and other carcinogens. And as a result, Houston has experienced some of the worst air quality of the year just amid the hurricane.
I mentioned plant officials, local regulators, state regulators say it's not a problem. Why do you think that that assessment isn't any good?
Well, that doesn't line up with the facts. As I said, Houston's having some of the worst smog days of the year right now. We also know that there's been high readings of benzene from air monitors. Many of the air monitors were shut down during the hurricane in order to protect the equipment. And so we didn't have monitoring during some of the worst pollution releases, but the monitoring that's happened since has shown unsafe levels. And people in the area are complaining of headaches and watery eyes and other symptoms that are related to pollution exposure.
So that's the air. Let's talk about the water. There are more than a dozen federally designated Superfund sites that were flooded and damaged by the hurricane. What's known about the environmental risk there? As these sites flood, the water recedes. You would have to be worried that toxic chemicals could go along with the flood water when it starts to go down.
we are worried. I toured one of the Superfund sites, the San Jacinto River waste pits, last week, and that site hasn't been finally remediated. It's basically covered with a tarp, covered by rocks, and the company responsible argues that it's sufficient, but we know that the tarp was moved with the storm, and there is a risk that pollutants were released. And that site has dioxins, which are the most dangerous substance known to humankind. And so we don't have full testing data yet, but there's definitely a real concern that pollution was released from some of these sites.
Well, Luke Metzger, locals around the Houston area have so many concerns right now, including getting back to their homes, rebuilding. The list is so long. What can locals do to worry about these air and water problems right now to do a little bit to protect their health in a couple seconds here?
Well, everyone is focused on cleaning up their houses. They can definitely do things like wearing masks with filters, wearing gloves to make sure they minimize their exposure to some of these chemicals that might be in the floodwaters or the air around them or the mold they might be growing in their homes right now.
All right. Luke Metzger, Director of Advocacy Policy Group, Environmental Texas. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Todd.
We go now to Arkansas for a look at an unusual legal case that could define how private companies behave when they're paid to administer justice. Craighead County in northeastern Arkansas is home to just over 100,000 people. And for about 20 years, a private probation company called the Justice Network had an exclusive deal to manage and enforce that county's probation system. Many locals started to view the Justice Network as predatory, and a couple of people even ran for office to stop it. Then the lawsuits followed, and it's all at the center of the Marshall Project's Case in Point this week. Senior editor Andrew Cohen is here to explain.
Let's say you get a speeding ticket, and you get on probation, and you have to pay a fine. The probation company takes over, and you have to pay that fine. And if you don't pay that fine in a certain amount of time, the company comes back to the judge and says, listen, you either threaten this person with jail, or we're going to add on another fine, and then another fine, and another fine. And so you had people who owed thousands of dollars, up to $10,000, for what amounted to a petty offense that wouldn't have generated that kind of fine in a million years. And of course, the higher that they got into debt, the less they were able to pay, and the more they defaulted, it became sort of an economic model. So what happens is, first, the clergy in the town begin to complain about the process. Newspaper reporters, editorials began to cry out, this is not fair. And then finally, a couple of years ago, you had two individuals in the county who decided they were going to do something about it, and they ran for a judicial position inside the county. They basically ran in a judicial election, and the campaign was basically, if you elect us, good folks of Craighead County, Arkansas, we are going to do something about this probation company.
There are over $20 million in unpaid court fines and fees due Craighead County District Court. Excessive fines mean some people are always in debt to the court. Taxpayers are footing the bill. District Court has even been collecting some fees illegally. It's time for a new direction in our District Court.
Sure enough, they get elected, and sure enough, they make good on their campaign promise. They begin to whittle away at the power this company has over this county.
The crackdown starts, and then what happens?
The crackdown starts, and it's successful. People begin to feel that the economic pressure from this company is eased. Fees are waived. In some cases, the contracts are nullified. And the company sues. So the company now is saying that the judges and the legal system, you could say, is undermining the contractual rights it's supposed to have with these probationers, and it is asking for damages. And that's where this lawsuit is right now. The company basically making these extraordinary arguments in federal court, the judges, the city, the county, all of them responding with motions to dismiss the case, saying, look, we have immunity, we have judicial immunity, and we have legal immunity from this. We can't be responsible. And by the way, we are doing, the judges are doing, what judges are supposed to do, which is try to ensure that the criminal justice system works with a measure of equal protection, with a measure of due process, and without any sort of a debt or prison. So it's a fascinating case that I just haven't heard of before.
Andrew Cohen, you know, when you look at the practices of a company like the Justice Network, and they're legal and they're not alone, increasingly, you know, it doesn't seem like their work has much to do with justice or accountability or even the law. It really seems like, as is the case with predatory lenders and a lot of other companies, that it's really about capitalizing off of poverty. capitalizing off of people's inability to pay. Hey, if these people are on probation, chances are they won't be able to pay a fine and we can make more. And chances are they won't be able to pay that second fine and we can make more. And it's not really about justice at all.
Yeah, I mean, the economic model is part of the problem here, and the oversight is part of the problem here. You could look at other jurisdictions, like let's take Ferguson, Missouri, just quickly. There was predatory policing there, famously, right, that was discovered in the wake of the Michael Brown shooting. That was a public situation. Those were public judges and public prosecutors who were doing essentially the same thing. This is a private sort of situation, so it's you're even more removed when it comes to a level of accountability and transparency and oversight, where you don't have somebody who has elected responsibility necessarily, who's saying, you know what, this is going way too far. We cannot simply keep burdening these relatively poor people. Another thing to say about this case, part of the reason why the judges acted the way they did once they were elected as reformers was because there was evidence to suggest that there was racial disparities in the way that these probationary services were being applied. Now, look, the company, no one went after the company. Nobody sued the company and said, you're being discriminatory. We should be clear about that. And the company isn't suing the judges or asking for, to continue the process to be allowed to continue this. What it's essentially saying, again, is that there's this interference with this contractual right. And if the federal courts say, yes, there is a contractual right here that has to be recognized under the Constitution, and judges, elected judges, are unable to sort of interfere with that right on behalf of people who are being preyed upon, in their view, then you have a really major story. I don't know that it's going to go in that direction, but the fact that the company would think that it's worth the shot here to make this argument, to me, is itself fascinating.
Are there jurisdictions, states, counties, cities that use private probation companies that are getting it right?
I think that there are private probation companies that operate with more oversight, that operate with a set of rules that are less predatory, that are less of a concern. I think if you were to talk to advocates who litigate in this area, there's a reason why they go after certain counties, the way things work in certain counties and the way things don't work in certain counties. And I think we're sort of still at the beginning of the trend of the sort of pushback. And it'll be interesting to see if the reform against private probation companies continues or if there's some pushback. Clearly, this litigation, the fact that there was a lawsuit filed, is a form of pushback from the companies who are saying, wait a minute, we've done nothing wrong. We had valid contracts, and they did, to perform a service, which they did. The question is, are you allowed to perform that service? What happens when that service begins to raise constitutional questions about due process and equal protection and this prohibition that's been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court against the idea of debtor's prisons? You're not supposed to be able to threaten someone with jail for a mere failure to pay a bill.
Andrew Cohen, senior editor with the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. Hey, Andrew, thanks for being with us again.
My pleasure, Todd. Anytime.
We have an update for you now on the last Case in Point story that we brought you. Victor Rosario had his conviction overturned after serving more than 30 years behind bars. We've now learned that Rosario will not face a second trial for a 1983 fire in Lowell, Massachusetts that killed 8 people. You can hear our original story about the Rosario case by heading over to our website at thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillick.
The roof was, removed, and what was happening is that it got all wet, so structure is cracking. So at any time, it's gonna collapse.
Lots of broken trees, actually a tree that fell onto our neighbor's roof and actually caved the roof in, and in the middle of the storm, he was running to our house to get safety.
This house is made out of concrete, and look what it did. It blew the whole thing off. If somebody would have been there, they would have been dead.
I have no internet, no service of any type at all.
I was on battery backup for 8 hours to still get the news and all during the storm because we were out of power.
It's real hard. A lot of people lost a lot of stuff.
We've been through a couple hurricanes before, but nothing like this.
The voices of Floridians there confronting the aftermath of Hurricane Irma. Florida is beginning to assess the destruction left by the storm, both in the short and the long term. Now, Florida has the most people and the most property at risk from climate change. More than 6 million Floridians and their homes are susceptible to rising sea levels. Now, scientists have warned on this show and elsewhere that no single storm can be attributed to climate change. But they also say that the future is clear. Rising seas, warmer waters, and more intense hurricanes. Still, out of Florida's top three Republican leaders, which include the governor, Rick Scott, only State President Joe Negron acknowledges that human activities contribute to climate change. It's also been reported that Rick Scott has discouraged state employees from using terms like climate change and global warming, although he's denied any official ban on those terms in Florida. But places like Miami in Florida are on the front lines of the reality of climate change. Joining me now to talk about how his state is handling the challenge, Mayor Tomas Regalado. He's a Republican. He's been mayor of Miami since 2009. Mayor Regalado, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Yes, definitely there is an element of climate change of what we are seeing here in Miami. I tell you that I grew up here in Miami. I've been to dozens of storms as a journalist and as an elected official. For 24 years, first as a commissioner and then mayor, I can tell you that the storm surge that we had during Irma, and mind you, as you very well know, we dodged the big bullet, but still, the storm surge was very, very unusual. I have seen, you know, the waters when they're angry, but not as we saw it. Brickell, which is the heart of the economic district of the city of Miami, was flooded. Luckily, we have pumps working since after immediately the storm, and now it's clear. However, what we saw was very, very different as years before. We also had an event in August, Todd, that it was very unusual, and no one at the National Weather Service was able to explain. We were told you can expect today, this was in August, maybe half an inch of rain, and yet in 1 hour we had 5 inches. The sewer system was overwhelmed, and we had flooding also in the Brickell area. We have been working with very high-end neighborhoods in the city of Miami, like Bellmead and Shortcrest, and they have experienced a storm surge even on a normal day. So now here in Miami, what we have is the will, a political will, to do something by ourselves. I believe that we cannot just wait for Tallahassee or Washington to acknowledge that something is going on, and we need to start a conversation. We've gone above and beyond. We have a referendum during the elections in November 7th, where we are asking the people of Miami to approve a bond issue where $200 million are going to climate change, sea level rise, and flooding.
Mayor, let me ask you about that, because you're here with this unequivocal message that you and the citizens of Miami know that climate change is connected, maybe not to one individual storm, but to the patterns that you're seeing that are affecting your city and your citizens directly. But you're a Republican mayor, and I want to know what you see when you look to Tallahassee or Washington and you see so many people in your party unwilling to address this in a meaningful way. You're a mayor of a city on the front lines, as I mentioned, with people's livelihoods, their jobs, their houses. And I don't ask this in a partisan way, but in the spirit of policy and the bond that you're talking about and doing addressing climate change directly on your own, can the people of South Florida trust Republicans in the state or in Washington to take this problem seriously?
I think they should, and I think they will, because what we saw in Houston and what we just experienced here in Miami has the people not thinking but willing to step up and do something. And like you said, we are on the front line. 100,000 residents of the city of Miami, which is a 500,000 strong residents, live on the waterfront. We have the most exposed assets in many parts of the country. So it's for the benefit of the state of Florida and the United States that we do something, and that Washington and Tallahassee understand that they need not to expand, but to invest in the future of Miami. That's why, Todd, we're calling this bond issue Miami Forever, because if we don't do something by ourselves, if we just wait to see if someone wants or has the will to have a conversation about climate change and at least analyze and do something, it would be too late for us.
Mr. Mayor, where is the pressure? So often in situations like this, as you know, it takes pressure from donors and supporters to move politicians in a way they don't want to go. Where's the pressure from the big companies and the big interests in Florida? Tourism, insurance companies, agriculture companies, leaning on lawmakers or elected officials to take climate change more seriously. Is that pressure going on behind the scenes, or is it non-existent?
Well, Todd, you know, I think that the insurance companies will expect billions of billions of dollars of losses had we had been hit by Irma as a Cat 5 or a Cat 4 here in Miami. We, as I said before, we dodged the big bullet. However, we have losses, and not as much as we were told that we will. But things happen. I mean, we've never seen three hurricanes in the Caribbean Basin or the Atlantic going around and around at the same time. We have never seen a storm surge as we saw it during Irma, and it wasn't only a Cat 1. So, you know, there's got to be a conversation. But, you know, if no one wants to listen, we have to do it by ourselves. After all, I am a Republican, yes, but I wasn't elected by the fellows in Tallahassee or in Washington. I was a Republican before Rick Scott and Donald Trump, and I will be a Republican after Rick Scott and Donald Trump. I know that that there are some voices in the state that want to have this conversation, but the fact of the matter is that we don't have time, and this is why I really believe that we have to do what we have to do.
Mayor Tomas Regalado is the mayor of Miami. Mayor, thank you for being here.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.
Fallon from Charlotte, North Carolina. The North Carolina legislature does not appear to believe that climate change is happening. The North Carolina legislature is Republican controlled. It is my understanding that at one point they passed a law requiring the Coastal Development Commission to only use historical sea rise information for future planning.
I'm Suzanne from Burns, Oregon, and I think the issue with climate change is that we're looking in the wrong direction. We're trying to solve the problems using corporate-level solutions when everybody wants to do something more alternative, alternative energy, tiny houses, water conservation. At the personal level, we're not being allowed to do these things because of overregulation.
Your voice is at 8778 My Take. We always want them here on the show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.